Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia, and coming up on the program, when prevention is better than cure, should Australia do more to target conflict prevention with development funding in the Pacific? Fiji's Buller FC and Vanuatu United going head-to-head in a battle for the last semi-final place in the OFC Pro League, and Pacific bragging rights. And gold smuggling on the rise in PNG, but perhaps officialdom is finally getting to grips with the situation. I'm Richard Hewitt, and Pacific Beach is produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. First this morning, the political future of Solomon Islands will be decided later today when MPs cast their ballots for a new Prime Minister. On the streets of Honiara, security will be tight with extra police officers on duty tasked with keeping the peace. Meanwhile, out of sight and behind closed doors, three candidates, or in reality maybe only two, will be vying for the minimum 26 votes they require to succeed Jeremiah Manelli as their country's next leader. The ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Kristen Rita Amano Leong, is following developments for Pacific Beat.
It's a likely fight between two candidates. And on the streets of Honiara, allegiances are mixed.
I want to see Matthew Wale take up this leadership. I want the new PM to develop our provincial headquarters and our roads.
I want to see continuity in government, so Peter Chanel is my choice.
Solomon Islands MPs will today elect a new Prime Minister in a secret ballot, with two favourites emerging, long-time opposition leader Matthew Wale and former Foreign Minister Peter Chanel Angovaka. Political watchers don't expect third candidate Manase Mailanga to have the numbers, but according to former Australian High Commissioner to Solomon Islands and Pacific politics expert James Batley, the likely winner is anyone's guess.
I'd be really reluctant to talk about who's the favourite and who isn't, because as we all know, negotiations on these issues can continue right up to the last minute.
Today's leadership change comes after former Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele was forced out of the PM seat last week after 2 years in charge, following a no-confidence vote. Mr. Manele, a soft-spoken diplomat, steadied the country's relations with Australia after the turbulent reign of China-friendly PM Manase Songaware, who signed a controversial security pact with Beijing.
I don't think we will see a return to the days of, I think the former Prime Minister Songaware had quite a particular take on relations, and that certainly toned down during the time that Mr. Manelli's been Prime Minister.
Most political watchers saw Mr. Manelli's ousting as a simple power grab, and in the past, changes in leadership have triggered rioting in the capital, Honiara. Although no civil unrest is expected today, up to 1,000 local police will be patrolling the streets. Speaking this week in his final press conference as leader, Mr. Manele urged all citizens to abide by the rule of law.
To my fellow Solomon Islanders here and abroad, let us show the world that leadership may change, that our respect for peace, unity and democracy is stronger than ever before.
On today's vote, candidates Mr. Wale and Mr. Angovaka have both been in Parliament for around 2 decades and share similar views on most major topics. Yet on China, the historical views differ, with Mr. Wale an outspoken critic of the 2022 security pact with China. Yet he is not expected to repeal the pact if he were to become PM. James Batley again.
I think any of the three candidates will take a cautious and considered approach to foreign affairs, whether it's thinking about China or thinking about Australia. I think whoever ends up as Prime Minister will try to work with all of Solomon Islands' foreign partners. I think the Australian government will want to re-emphasise the fact that Australia remains, by a long way, Solomon Islands' most important external partner.
Back on the streets of Honiara, after a long political stalemate over who will lead the country, the people say they just want to see positive change, regardless of the winner.
I don't know who will be the new PM, but I want to see a PM who will make decisions in the best interests of the people.
View from the streets of Honiara, ending that report from Pacific Beats, a reporter in Solomon Islands, Chris and Rita Amana Leong. We're joined now by the editor of Melanesian News Network, Dorothy Wickham. Dorothy, good morning. Thanks for taking time out to join us on Pacific Beats.
Good morning.
So what do you make of it all? I mean, three names essentially on the ballot paper, but by the sound of it, this is a battle between two. Is that your view?
Yes, I think it is. As Chris and Rita said, public opinion is, people are fed up, actually. They just want to get a new prime minister, start moving again. The country's been through a big cyclone, and of course we've had issues with the fuel supply because of the war in Iran. And there's a whole of other things that Solomon Islanders face every day, just, you know, surviving. So it's not good for them to be hearing, you know, rumours of MPs being paid to shift back and forth, of MPs staying in hotels to solve this issue. And it's making ordinary Solomon Islanders a bit frustrated.
If people are seeking change and a fresh start, they're most likely to get it, aren't they, from the long-time opposition leader Matthew Wale, because Pirangavoka essentially represents the current government. It'll just be moving the furniture, won't it, if he's elected?
Well, that's the current opinion. I think on social media, I was scrolling through the other day, and I think there's a shift towards thinking that Matthew Wale is the best choice at this time. Because, yes, like you said, people want to see change.
But we heard, though, that Matthew Wale was not keen on Solomon Islands' switch from diplomatic relations with Taiwan to China back in 2022. The suggestion is that he wouldn't attempt to change things, but that might sort of send a bit of a shudder through Canberra's corridors, mightn't it?
Well, I think, you know, that subject of China, I think it's obsolete now, I think. Solomon Islanders are used to China being here now, and I think what needs to be done now is for the government to concentrate on ensuring that the daily lives of Solomon Islanders get easier and that they see a leap, or at least some growth in the economy, and ensuring that, you know, no more services like health and education and transportation and the supply of water and electricity gets to ordinary people. I think that's where the focus is now of all Solomon Islanders.
So if we're ruling Manasseh Maelanga out of the equation effectively, Matthew Wale brought this situation about once the courts ordered that Parliament reconvene by winning a vote of no confidence. And in order to do that, of course, he had to have more votes than the sitting Prime Minister, Jeremiah Minnelli. So if MPs are consistent, it should be Matthew Wale's election, shouldn't it?
But I think people must also remember the motion of no confidence wasn't brought forth by the opposition grouping. It was brought to the floor of Parliament by one of the defecting MPs from GNAT grouping, I think. And I think it was supported by the group that left GNAT. I think that's why it got through the floor of Parliament. I think if it was brought through by opposition itself, it wouldn't have succeeded.
So therefore, we can anticipate a lot of jockeying for position behind those closed doors. And I suppose the reality is the only thing that the voters of Solomon Islands are going to know is the result. They're not really going to know what happened at all, are they? Unless MPs are prepared to talk off the record or on the record once the vote is over.
That's right. It's typical Solomon Islands politics. We just don't know until they walk out the front door of Parliament to announce the winner.
And if it were to go to Peter Angavoka, I mean, the fact that he, as it were, jumped ship to help bring about this situation in the first place and then went back the other way, I mean, would it be a status quo if he were to be elected in terms of how the government would operate?
Yes, a little bit of that, but I think we might see a change in cabinet ministers under his leadership.
And would that necessarily mean fresh talent getting a go, possibly younger MPs, and that in itself could be a way of refreshing government for Solomon Islands?
Yes, and also I think the most important thing, if he's going by what the public is thinking and what people want, I think it's more of the removal of certain MPs that he's not happy with, plus what the public knows has been going on within the cabinet, especially when they're holding ministerial portfolios. I think this is where the crunch is going to be, because I think that's one of the reasons he walked away, was he was not happy with certain ministers.
So what do you think it will take to bring stability, if you like? I mean, will whatever happens with the election today be enough to solidify government?
I think at this point, and just gauging from what was said on the floor of Parliament during the debate on the motion, there needs to be a little bit more respect for consultation, the consultation process between the parties who have formed the coalition. I think that was where the unhappiness was coming from, that there were certain people inside the Jinnah group who had too much power and were influencing certain things, that those 11 MPs who walked away weren't happy with it. They wanted more consultation and agreement to certain decisions before they were being made.
And if the election were to go the other way, if Matthew Wali were to secure the prime ministership, it's been a long time waiting for him in Parliament. He's been around for a very long time now. So I guess some people might say he's earned his chance.
Yes, absolutely. I think... And Matthew is a person who would not allow for certain things to take place, as we have seen that's been happening within the Jinnah government. Matthew's tone when he spoke during the motion of no confidence was, I think, a tone of a little of sadness, because I think he respected Mr. Manele as a leader. And of course, we know government is not only led by one man, it's made up of cabinets and caucus, of course, and so the decisions that were being made in the background were obviously not 100% of Manele's making, and I think Matthew knew that, and that's why I think his tone was of sadness to see a good leader being pushed aside, because never mind what the public has to say, there's big support for Manele, because they've seen his stabilizing effect as a leader, his tone with the donor community, his wordings, even during at the height of the pressure for him to step down, he kept his tone very neutral, which has led to, I think, the reaction from the public being accepting and also letting the process take place. Because it's always, what we've had before here, and because of social media, of course, too, is that people were starting to talk about ethnic groupings, provincial lines, which then caused agitation between each grouping. And Manele was very good at maintaining that calm and speaking language that kept everybody happy to let the process take place and not to be taking sides based on ethnicity or, you know, the one talk system or if it's constituency. So I think that's where I think, going back to what Matthew would be doing, I think he would be also very aware of this and would be taking a leadership line in this regard. But he's also very consistent in his arguments about corruption, in his arguments about malpractice, and wanting government to own up and to be transparent and to be accountable. And I think that's what the public is wanting right now. And that's why there's that lean towards Matthew Wallace being the next leader.
So tell me, Dorothy, final point. I mean, what's your gut feeling? I mean, you've been watching politics in Solomon Islands for a long time now, and I think you know and I know that the changes can be many over the hours that it will take to resolve this battle. But what's your feeling about how it will turn out in the end?
Oh, gosh. After watching it for so long, I also know that you can't really tell at this point. If it was a clear two candidates, two party choice, I think we'd have a clearer picture. It's very difficult to tell now because there's also a lot of unhappiness on both sides, I think, of the two main groupings. So there's going to be a lot of talking and agreeing to certain things before anything can really happen both ways at the moment.
All right, well, we'll get a winner, I presume, at some stage later today. It'll be interesting to see how it does all play out. But, Dorothy, we appreciate your insights. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Thank you.
Dorothy Wickham there, editor of Melanesian News Network, with her thoughts on how things might play out in that prime ministerial election in Solomon Islands later today. Three candidates, but effectively only two by the sound of it. So will it be Peter Angavoka or will it be longtime opposition leader Matthew Wally, who is prime minister by this time tomorrow? Now, next up, ahead of Papua New Guinea's national election next year, there are already mounting fears of a fresh wave of tribal violence, with estimates suggesting there are some 100,000 illegal firearms circulating across the country. But a recent blog post for the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University argues that the difference between stability and violence is not the absence of risks, such as that posed by a disputed election result, but the presence of trusted local mechanisms to manage the situation. The writers go on to suggest that conflict prevention only works when development investments are deliberately designed to address the grievances and power imbalances that drive people towards violence. We're joined now by the co-author of that blog post, the Chief Executive of World Vision Australia, Grant Baildon. Grant, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So just to pick up on that point, prevention only works when development investments are deliberately designed to address the grievances and power imbalances that drive people towards violence. That's a powerful statement. So in your view, what needs to change? How should development investments from Australia in the Pacific be targeted differently in the future?
Well, the first thing to say is that there's lots that is done right at the moment, and we've just seen the Australian government investment through their budget maintained and in fact further funds directed towards the Asia Pacific region. So that's really an opportunity to do more of this, and that's how we're seeing this. The results have been really well established. The OECD report says that at least 26-1 return on investment into peace building and conflict prevention. So there's a great body of evidence. There's work already underway. Really, what we're needing to see is more focus on this work. That programs, development programs, are designed with conflict prevention in mind. So that means things like asking, what are the tensions, what are the pressures going on in communities that are driving conflict, leading to dispute, and will the investment made in development interventions address those, or even could they inadvertently make it worse by exacerbating some tensions? And not every country and not every place needs that kind of focus and lens. But there's some places that do. You called out PNG, Solomon Islands, another one, Philippines, particularly Mindanao. Those are areas that are high risk, and where there's development investment going on, it's really smart to make sure that there is a real focus on conflict prevention.
The blog post also talks about the most effective route to prevention happens when women and young people do not just participate, but actually lead. Now, I know aspirationally that this sort of thing is talked about around the Pacific, but it's not that easy to achieve, is it? I mean, there are cultural issues at play here.
Well, women are already leading in so many ways in communities, of course, managing household resources, organizing community resources when things go wrong, when we see disasters. The key question there is, are they being drawn into the formal decision-making processes? We see the same with young people who so often have so much energy ideas and bring a lot to this work as well, is making sure that their voices are actually brought in, making sure it's inclusive. That the more formal power structures there, the chiefs, churches, government bodies, right up to representation at national level, is where the biggest opportunity is for young people and women to have their voices heard more. An example of that would be, say, at a peace forum, making sure that young people in a community have a defined voice in that, that they feel like they have an important role, and that they're being listened to, because that's one of the keys that's been shown time and again to make a difference and to make this work actually have lasting impact.
To what degree, though, is the situation and the sort of thing that you're aiming for, if you like, being undermined by the very people who should be stabilising their countries, namely the leaders and those in officialdom? Because, for example, looking at PNG again, I mean, we know that there are claims of illegal weapons being supplied to rival tribes through local politicians. The police and the military are said to be involved in supplying weapons. I mean, if that is happening, it's a pretty difficult situation to manage, isn't it?
I can't speak to the specifics of where weapons are coming from there, but certainly the proliferation of weapons in PNG is really concerning and adds fuel to the underlying problems there. What we see, though, is that weapons don't proliferate where people believe that institutions will protect them, where people believe that disputes will be resolved fairly. We see that not just in the Pacific, but right around the world. So that takes us back to this underlying work at a community level, good governance, takes away many of the drivers. Particularly, another really really important part of this is that young people have hope for the future. They feel like they have opportunities, like their voices are heard, and that means that they're far less easily recruited into violence.
As regards the money that is input from Australia in terms of the broadly development, I mean, do you feel that it needs to be more closely monitored to ensure that it is being used in the best possible way?
What we see is those funds are well monitored at the moment. It's more about the design of the program. So there's very good programs being run. The opportunity here is to focus them more on conflict prevention, to really get a more powerful and more positive outcome. So we'd say that's a big opportunity here.
And for your own organization, I mean, do you feel that, shall we say, in simple terms, that the money that you invest could be not necessarily better spent, but could produce better outcomes if it's used in the way that you're describing here?
Yeah, we're focusing as much as we can on bringing conflict prevention in. Where we're working with grant funds from major donors like the Australian government and others, we do have to fulfil the grant obligations, which in some cases do include conflict prevention work. For us, it's a matter of working with the grant providers to ensure that we can do that right across the programs and actually allocate the funds to do it properly.
And just to go back to our starting point and the elections coming up in Papua New Guinea next year, I mean, we've already spoken on this program to people in the field who suggest that, unfortunately, not enough has been done in PNG since the last election to sort out the problems that they had then, and indeed pretty much every election in recent memory. So There is a point to be addressed here, isn't there? Is it still too late, therefore, to step in and prevent possible trouble next year?
The window's certainly still open to make a difference now, but it won't stay open for too much longer. Change takes time. We can't just parachute in the months leading up to the election and expect it to have a meaningful impact. And it's the same thing with preventing election violence that works for preventing conflict more broadly, making sure that community-led systems can absorb pressure, good good dispute resolution, young people who have a stake in the community and you know, aren't easily drawn to violence. Now's the time to be working on those things, not once the news cycle really starts to focus on the election there, then it will certainly be too late.
Grant Baldwin, thank you very much indeed for your time and for joining us on Pacific Beat this morning.
Thank you so much.
Grant Baldwin there, Chief Executive of World Vision Australia, co-author of that blog post, the co-author being Stephen Killilea, founder of the Institute for Economics and Peace, the independent think tank behind the Global Peace Index. And you can read the blog that the two gentlemen have written in full if you go to devpolicy.org on the internet.
Disasters are a reality of life in the Pacific, but so is the strength and resilience of its people. Pacific Prepared shares first-hand stories from communities on the ground, drawing on tradition, culture, and collective wisdom to stay safe and support one another in times of disaster. Pacific Prepared explores how communities are adapting and protecting what matters most. Pacific Prepared, Fridays from 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hold the front page!
Yes, I think it's kind of a digital front page these days, and holding it on this occasion for us at Pacific Beat, Dana is with me once again. Good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
Our big story this morning, of course, is the Prime Ministerial election in Solomon Islands, but here's another story from that part of the world. Members of the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary are in a bit of strife. They've been flown back to PNG after they were accused of threatening locals with firearms.
Yes. So according to Indeth Solomon's, four RPNGC members were driving when they collided with a stationary civilian vehicle that had stopped to give way to oncoming traffic. One eyewitness claimed that the officers appeared to be intoxicated and assaulted members of the public and then also threatened them with a gun. Upon entering their vehicle, they did identify themselves as PNG police, but didn't say why they were there in the area or what they were doing specifically there.
So what kind of response have the officers been met with in terms of what they may or may not have done?
Yeah, well, pretty quickly, almost immediately, in a police media conference on Thursday, the Solomon Islands Commissioner of Police, Ian Viavaso, said that while he has not yet received a full report on exactly what happened, the PNG authorities responded immediately by removing the officers from active duty. He also noted that the officers have paid compensation to the local residents involved. Now, the RPNG personnel were part of a deployment that was done earlier that were intended to support the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force in maintaining law and order, as well as assisting humanitarian assistance and disaster relief operations following Tropical Cyclone Mila.
All right, to Fiji next, an abandoned pistol magazine containing 11 live 9mm rounds has been confirmed to have not come from the Fijian military inventory. So what does this add up to?
Yeah, so the magazine was discovered on Tuesday and immediately triggered a joint investigation by the Republic of Fiji military forces and the Fiji police. In a statement, the RFMF confirmed that the ammunition was found by a member of the public at about 5 a.m. near a bus stop near the Naisinu police station in the Makoi area. Preliminary assessments conducted by the military confirmed that the magazine and ammunition were not part of the RFMF inventory, but are now in their custody. And so now investigations are being jointly conducted by the RFMF and the police to determine the origin of the ammunitions and the circumstances surrounding its discovery.
So a rogue weapon by the sound of it. Finally, to Vanuatu, fishers in Toba province, they'll soon benefit from access to new fish aggregating devices, FADs, I think they're called.
Yes.
They aimed at improving access to fish and reducing fuel costs, which would be pertinent right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, the fish aggregating devices, or FADs, which is unfortunate naming, are floating structures used to attract and concentrate open water fish, improving fishing efficiency simply because you know they're going to be in the area. year. The Department of Fisheries has approved 3 FAD deployment sites this year for the Toowoomba province, according to the VBTC. Toowoomba Fisheries Officer Herve Hopkind said that the project is funded by the government and is expected to bring major benefits to the local fishermen and communities because they'll no longer have to waste fuel or time searching for fish, and they can now go directly to the source.
So, more fish on the plates by the sound of it, and a little bit more money in the fishers' pockets, which has got to be good all round, hasn't it? Dana, thanks very much indeed for the update.
No worries. Thank you, Richard.
You're with Pacific Beats here on ABC Radio Australia for a Friday morning. And as the inaugural AFC Pro League season approaches its climax, 3 teams, South Melbourne, Auckland FC and South Island United, have secured their semi-final places. The 4th spot will go to the winners of Sunday's playoff between Fiji's Bulla FC and Vanuatu United. For the Fijians, the match is a chance for redemption after losing all 3 of their games in the leaders' playoff group. In contrast, their opponents came through the Challengers playoff group unbeaten with 2 wins and a draw. So based on form, perhaps Vanuatu United could be considered favourites to win the one-off game and make history by becoming the first team from Pacific Islands to make the last 4. And all being well, we'll be chatting to the coach of Vanuatu United, Lars Hopp, in just a few minutes' time. What we can do is move on to matters from PNG in terms of gold smuggling, which has cropped up once or twice in the programme in recent days. And a recent inquiry has found that illegal gold exports have been costing the Papua New Guinea economy as much as 300 million kina every year. But perhaps the tide is turning. So as you were, back to the OFC Pro League. I'm pleased to say that Lars Hopp is with us. Lars, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us on Pacific Beat once again.
Good morning, Richard. How are you?
Well, thank you. And I imagine you and your team are in pretty good mood, aren't you? 2 wins and a draw to get through the Challengers group and into the semi-finals against Buller FC, who are looking a little bit shaky. I mean, it's there for the taking, isn't it, for your team to make the semi-finals?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're very happy to be in that playoff position. That was our first goal. And at the same time, we feel we deserved it because in this Challengers group, I think we delivered solid performances and looking forward to the game on Sunday.
They say in sport that momentum is everything. I mean, it would seem to me it's all on your side at the moment.
Well, you know, I've said it before, momentum I think is something you create by getting the details right, doing the little things right, and just doing your job basically. And what comes out of that is just the end result. So we'll keep focusing on, everyone in the group, be it players, staff, just making sure we do everything for the best of the team. And then hopefully it can give us a good result in the end.
Now, during the circuit series, I think it's fair to say that Vanuatu United's form was a bit up and down. You'd play a good game and then a next game maybe not quite so good. But in the playoff series, you had this consistency and you seem to be playing a pretty good style of football at the moment. So, I mean, I guess that's exactly what you were looking for. And the development of the side is also what you've been looking for with a brand new franchise starting from scratch.
Yeah, absolutely. I think all the newly started clubs, they would have needed some time to just get everything together, you know, be it on the administration side, but also on the field, you know, the staff, everyone just had to find each other. And I think that's, we've analyzed the season so far before the Challengers round. And, you know, there's many reasons why sometimes results don't go your way. But what we've always tried to do is to keep learning as a group. So if anything happens that's not good, put it on the table, but not with a finger and blaming people, but just learning as a group. And I think some of those things they've obviously improved. It's not perfect yet, but we'll keep this learning habit also through this, or we've kept it through the Challengers group, and we'll keep it through the upcoming games as well.
And going into this match against Buller FC on Sunday, it's pretty handy that you have the top goal scorer in the entire competition in your side, I would suggest. 11 goals now, I think, for Alex Daniel. He's had such a great tournament.
Yeah, he's been fantastic for us. At the same time, I think, humble as he is, he would be the first to point out that every goal we score is always a team goal.
because it takes a lot of work to create that end product. We're very happy to have him in our team, and he's dealt with the attention that has come his way in a great way, because he's just always keeps humble and stays humble, and always pointing that he's just one of many in our group. And I think that's why everyone is also so happy for him, because I think that's something that we try to establish in this group, that we're actually happy for each other's success. And hopefully it can carry us a bit of the way still.
Now, I recall a little earlier in the season during the Melbourne circuit, speaking to your goalkeeper, Matt Acton, and I asked him whether he was aware of interest from clubs overseas in what the Pro League was up to and what the Vanuatu United players were up to. And he said he was taking calls after pretty every match from people inquiring about players. So from a practical point of view, if I can put it that way, I mean, are you getting calls? Are the players generating interest, and might there be moves to follow after the season?
Yeah, we've got longer-term contracts with most of our players, but of course there's also the chance of sending players out on loan, which is actually something that we would actively support, because there's a long break after this tournament finishes until the next season resumes. So in the end, this club was also established to create a pathway, and the pathway should not necessarily end with playing for Vanuatu United, but I think it's a good shopping window for players to show themselves and make people see that they're ready for a higher level as well. And I think it's the league has fulfilled its purpose, because the games have been competitive. There's no easy games in this league, and if you're not up for it on the day, you'll get punished. So I think the standard has been good. It shows then the quality of the players if they're doing well in this league.
And just to come back to the big game coming up on Sunday, were you to beat Buller FC, you would claim that semi-final place, and who knows what may happen after that. You'd be up against South Melbourne, who finished top of the leaders group. But just defeating Buller FC, I mean, that would give Vanuatu United bragging rights in the Pacific, and I would have thought send a very clear signal to the tournament organisers that they have to take a circuit to Vanuatu next year.
Oh, we would love that, because Vanuatu is football crazy country, and the support and the love we get from back home has been fantastic throughout the campaign, be it win or lose. They've always been behind us. And it's a kind of a Pacific final now. Obviously we hope to claim that last semi-final spot. But in the day, it's going to be up to who's getting the most things right, and then a bit of luck on the match day.
And were you to get through and come up against South Melbourne, I mean, how would you rate your chances of going all the way to the grand final?
We've approached this tournament every time like this, that we really only focus on the next game. We know it would be South Melbourne waiting, and we've played them twice before. One win, one loss, so anything can happen at that stage. But right now we're really focused on Bula on Sunday, and we want to make sure that we leave everything on the field, that we prepare well, and that's our absolute focus at the moment.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out to join us. I know you're off to training very shortly. We wish you every success in that game against Bula FC on Sunday. Bragging rights are at stake, so best of luck to you and the players.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Last hop there, head coach of Vanuatu United FC. They take on Buller FC in that playoff game on Sunday at Mount Smart Stadium in Auckland. The winners go through to the OFC Pro League semi-finals. And as we say, there'll also be Pacific bragging rights, because basically whoever wins will be the best professional side in the Pacific.
Every game.
What a brilliant try!
Every week.
Beautiful!
Don't miss a minute of the NRL in 2026.
It's game on, baby! This is remarkable footy.
With Andrew Moore and the best team in the business.
What a performance. What a game. What a team.
Hear it all right here.
Unbelievable!
On ABC Radio Australia.
Game, set, bingo!
Your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Yep, another busy weekend on the NRL front to look forward to. Now, back to the question of illegal gold exports. And a recent inquiry has found that they have been costing the Papua New Guinea economy quite a lot. In fact, around 300 million kina every year. But perhaps the tide is turning. In recent months, there has been a marked increase in the number of gold smuggling attempts being intercepted. The latest example involved the seizure of 20 gold bars concealed, apparently not very well, in three suitcases. The chief executive of the National Airports Corporation, Dominic Kamu, says the intercepts are the result of improved working relations between his organisation and PNG Customs.
The gold smuggling issues has been going on for some time. But for us at the National Airports Corporation, we have taken steps to improve our training and our facilities as well, so that we can work together in partnership with customs and immigration as well in addressing the issue of gold smuggling. And in the past couple of months, we've picked up quite a number of them. There was a lady that was picked up recently. She had the gold nuggets all broken down, but she had a special bra on, and she actually had it in the bra as she was coming through. But the machines at the airport are designed to capture things like bombs and bullets and that kind of thing, not necessarily for gold. So what we have done is we've got a relationship with customs. So we've got customs to install one of their scanning machines prior to bags are put through our machines as well, because this is designed to capture gold and to identify gold as it comes through in checked-in baggages. And that also, in picking up some of those, is actually picked up by the teams in terms of profiling. The three recent suitcases were checked in, and we picked up one of the suitcases. So we picked up all three, but only one passenger turned up to check in. The other two passengers must have got wind of their bags being sidelined and never turned up. We handed those over to customs, and they take it on from there.
Yeah. And would you say the increase in the gold smuggling that's being caught is a product of an improvement in the security system and your cooperation with customs?
Correct, yes. And not only that, we are stepping up security in all our regional airports, such as Nedjeb Airport in Lae. Now, there's a lot of gold coming out of Bulolo, so we're stepping up processing in regional airports like Lae, Rabaul, Buka. There's a lot of gold coming out of Bougainville as well, that kind of thing.
I noticed again with a lot of the recent cases, a lot of them were headed to Hong Kong. Is there a reason for that, do you think? Where do you think the smuggling is coming from? Is it just because they don't want to pay?
I mean, look, these people are smart, so they do their own research as well. No one would want to go through Singapore, as an example, or even Australia, because they probably may be picked up. And I don't know. My personal thoughts are that this is some kind of a syndicate. So they would probably have people in Hong Kong, so it's easier to pass through Hong Kong. I have no idea. We picked up one to Singapore recently as well. But the majority of it is through Hong Kong. So something is happening in that there must be some kind of a syndicate, goes on to Hong Kong and moves on from there, I think.
Further investigations required by the sound of it. Sir Dominic Kamu, CEO of the National Airports Corporation in Papua New Guinea, he was talking to Dana Kerimoff. Pacific Beat. Now, two new helicopters have been donated to the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary by Australia. Their choppers will be used by the force's new air wing and for responding to humanitarian emergencies. The aviation company Manolos has been contracted to train local pilots, and it will be responsible for servicing the choppers. Company director and himself, a notable helicopter pilot, Jürgen Ruh, says the project will benefit the aviation industry and the police.
We've trained Papua New Guineans for 11 years because it's the right thing to do, not because government gives us money to do it. So we have a track record of training Papua New Guineans engineering and pilot-wise, and the government came in to give us the job of the police contract together with training, because they do know that we will train Papua New Guineans and we train them properly. In addition, the government has recognized the humanitarian work we've done over the years, and for 16 years, I have done humanitarian work relentlessly. And the government has recognized that. And the helicopters, which will be used for policing primarily, are also free to be used for humanitarian work when required. So for our own helicopters, number one is humanitarian work. Number two is anything else. For the police helicopter, number one will be policing work. Number two, we will do humanitarian work.
few companies or individuals, organizations that do humanitarian work in Papua New Guinea as well. Is that sort of a vote of confidence or recognition for the kind of work you do, especially in the humanitarian space?
Absolutely. This is a word of confidence. This is a word of recognition. And I'm very happy that the government has got confidence in us. They know what we've done for many years, and they are supporting us. They're giving us more resources to continue to do what we have been doing.
And I understand, Jürgen, that you will be training pilots as well under this arrangement. Can you tell us a bit more about that arrangement with training pilots?
So currently I've got a total of 4 pilots under training, and we have already produced the first Papua New Guinean female helicopter pilot. The second Papua New Guinean female helicopter pilot is doing her final runs in Australia this month. She next month will come back with a commercial license. I've got another trainee who has already gone as far as the private helicopter license. I have got another trainee who's already got a commercial fixed-wing license converting to rotary. And beginning of this year, we've already employed 2 more Papua New Guineans for the purpose of the police contract. And every 6 months now, I employ 2 people. I put them through the training. I make sure they start from the ground up, helicopter cleaning, helicopter preparation, loading, whatever. And then they slowly, slowly go through the process bit by bit. That's 6 months on the ground work. Then there will be 2 months of training. There will be again 4 months of the ground work. Then there's 3 months schooling and more training again. So during this year and next year, we are going to train a total of 6 more pilots, out of which we select the ones 4 which have got the best aptitude for the police, to the police force, and the 2 who are more suited for humanitarian work, we keep them ourselves. So we'll be training 6, 4 of them will be for the police. And then once the police contract is finished, or perhaps police have got their own air wing, they're capable of doing their own flying on their own, then those 4 pilots which we are training will go with the helicopter to the air wing, and Manolos Aviation will not be allowed to employ them for 2 years. That's part of the contract to ensure that we are not training our own pilots at the cost of someone else. So who is paying for the cost will also get the pilots.
And also, one of the busiest calendars in Papua New Guinea is the general elections, which are coming up next year. I would assume that with the addition of these 2 helicopters, it will save the government a lot of cost in terms of elections operations and the use of these 2 helicopters?
That is correct. In past elections, the government spent a lot of money on helicopters. And this time, the money they have to spend on helicopters for the elections will be far less, number one. Number 2, the benefit for the government will be they have got the helicopters under their control. They will say when the helicopter starts work, and they will say when the helicopter stops work. In past elections, they have helicopters on hire, for example, for 30 days. 30 days finished, the helicopters go back. And at the time, perhaps their job wasn't complete and they were left stranded to some extent. During this time for the elections, the job is complete. When the government says the job is complete,
one of the biggest costs, as you said, is the operations of helicopters. Will that also be under your care, and will the government be responsible for the care of these two?
That is correct. The government is responsible for the ongoing cost of maintenance of the helicopter and the operation and every aspect of a helicopter. We are actually ourselves providing the pilots, we are providing the oversight, we are providing the safety management, the proper planning for the helicopters, but all the costs in relation to operating the helicopter will be borne by the government, and I believe the government has put sufficient money aside to cover that. I'm very happy that the government has shown us, given us a vote of confidence in respect of choosing us as the best choice of all operators who have tendered for this job. And it's a vote of confidence for us, and it is very motivating, and we will make sure we do our best to deliver on the contract.
Jürgen Roux, pilot and company director for Manolos Aviation, looking after those 2 new helicopters donated to the Royal Papua New Guinea Constabulary from Australia. Jürgen was speaking there to Hilda Wayne. We'll have the afternoon show at 5:05 PNG time this afternoon, and then we'll be back to start all over again on Monday morning at 6:05 PNG time. Hope you can join us then. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks for your company this week. Have a great weekend.